Welcome, everyone, to The Demand Side. I'm your host, Edward Brown. On today's episode, we're talking about the different types of capitalism and attempting, if possible, to determine which one works best. Here to discuss is our very special guest, Professor Branko Milanović. Professor Milanović is a senior scholar at the Stone Center on Socioeconomic Inequality at the City University of New York. He previously served as lead economist in the World Bank's research department for almost 20 years and was a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Professor Milanović's main area of research is income inequality in individual countries and globally, including pre-industrial societies. His book, The Haves and the Have-Nots, was selected by The Globalist as the 2011 Book of the Year. His book, Global Inequality, was awarded the Bruno Kreisky Prize for Best Political Book of 2016. And his latest book, Capitalism Alone, which is what we'll be discussing today, examines the historical shifts that have led to capitalism's dominance and looks at the varieties of capitalism at work today to propose new choices that ensure capitalism delivers a more equitable future. Professor Milanović, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Ed. You know, Edward, it's really a pleasure to be back, and I really am very grateful for the re-invitation.
Well, we're so happy to have you back. As I said earlier, we're going to sort of take a deep dive into your book, Capitalism Alone, a book that really everyone should go out and buy because, you know, not only is it such a great read, but I think too often we look at capitalism in a rather binary way. And your book shows that there are, in fact, many different forms of capitalism currently at play and that it's unrivaled at the moment. But before we get into all that, why don't we just have you talk a little bit about the book and why you wanted to write about this topic?
Yes, well, as you said, actually, let me continue from the point that you made, actually, when you said capitalism is unrivaled, and this is indeed, actually, of course, implied by the title. The title, as you know, is somewhat intentionally ambivalent. It's capitalism, comma, that comma is there for a reason, alone. So being alone means you have no rival, you have one, you're really on the top of the world, which is very good. But being alone also means, and economists, of course, know that very well, is not having competition that actually pushes you to become better, more efficient, more just, or whatever else. So there is this ambivalence about being alone. Now, I think empirically, that was one of the reasons why actually I wrote that book. I thought actually that empirically, without us liking or disliking the fact that capitalism is the only mode system of production, it is a fact. And then when I say it is the fact, I mean by that after the fall of socialism and the Eastern Bloc, you had a spread of capitalism way of producing, and I will explain that more sort of clearly in a minute, to basically not only the former Soviet Union in Eastern Europe, but also to India since 1991, where actually India basically abandoned sort of semi-socialist ideas, and to China. Now, China, of course, many people don't agree with that, so I would leave that between brackets for a minute. But it is actually a very clear that it has really spread. Secondly, and I think that's something that I deal with the last part of the book, it has also spread into our ordinary behavior. And I think it's very important because I think it shows that our value system is very compatible with the profit motivation that is at the origin of capitalist system. So these are the two reasons that I had in mind: geographical spread, and I'm sure we'll discuss China in a minute, and the spread into our own system of values. So really, if you want micro and macro.
Right. So, you know, you say for the first time in history, the entire globe operates using the same economic principles, in essence, capitalism alone. There are other modes that exist, but those areas that operate under under those different modes of production have no real influence or impact on world developments. But you know, how did we get here? How did capitalism come to dominate? And is capitalism alone a good thing?
You see, how we got here, I think we should really sort of take a step back and look a little bit at the history. And this is what actually I spent quite a lot of time in chapter 3 discussing. If you go back, let's suppose you go back to 1850, 1870, 1890, that was considered rightly as a previous peak of capitalism and globalization. But at the same time, as we know, there was an alternative older mode of production, which was feudalism and slavery. I mean, obviously, as you in the United States, it existed until 1865, the slavery in Brazil until 1888, in many parts of India until the early 20th century. And even, of course, in Russia, serfdom was abolished in 1861. Central Europe, serfdom and forced labor abolished in 1848. So that other system was still very much present. So there was really still a competition. You know, the competition didn't end, in 1850. So it continued. So it was not in that sense alone. Now, it could be, and it's, of course, a huge counterfactual, that without World War I, you know, capitalism, many people believe, would have continued and essentially would have won over. And maybe we would have been at this current position with many fewer victims in, for example, 1930. We would not have had the 1930s that we actually did have. But it does pose one issue, which, of course, I think is very relevant for us now when we think also about the competition between China and the US. The question is the following: how come that all the dominant powers then, which were all very capitalist, and they were, of course, very integrated, and they knew, that was actually most interesting, they knew that the war would be a destructive war in which they would all lose. Why is that they didn't follow the precept what many people are saying, that the commerce would make it actually more peaceful? Why did they get engaged into the most destructive war up to that point, World War I? So I think this is an issue that actually I think it would really bother, you know, historians for a long time, probably forever, like the fall of Rome. And which we think we should think about this today as well, because we might sometimes think very glibly that the very fact that we are sort of interdependent, like China and the US are now, that it would protect us from a war. But the economies then were equally, or if not more, interdependent, interconnected, because one should not remember, should not forget that many of the leaders, meaning the different kings and emperors and so on, were personally connected. So this is the war of literally brother, you know, against the brother.
So yeah, for sure. What was so fascinating about me is, or fascinating in the book is, you know, how you explained how neither the Marxist nor the liberal approaches can explain what really happened in the 20th century. You said, quote, we thus reach the conclusion that two of the most important events in the global history of the 20th century, World War I and the fall of communism, cannot both be consistently explained within the liberal or Marxist paradigms. The liberal paradigm has a problem with 1914, and the Marxist paradigm with 1989. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by this and the alternative theory that you put forth to explain this?
You know, for the problem with 1914 with the liberal paradigm is basically what we already, you know, what I just said, is that that was the paradigm which was based on the idea that democratic or liberal societies, and actually if you look at all the major belligerents, they're like France and the UK and the United States were already democratic. Germany was moving very much in that direction. It had, of course, universally selected parliament. That parliament had, of course, some functions being controlled, including appointments of ministers by the emperor, but it was still a sort of a quasi-democratic state. The same is true for Austria-Hungary, and even for Russia, which had a Duma, you know. So, you know, these were not sort of tyrannies with only individual leaders, autocratic leaders deciding. So these were really first democracies, broadly speaking. Secondly, developed capitalist societies that were trading and investing and working together a lot. So then the question becomes, in a liberal paradigm, it is considered that if you have all these sort of features that I just mentioned, you realize that the war is really not an option because the war is really going to be destructive, whoever wins, and actually as it indeed happened. So then you had, of course, theories which go back to Montesquieu of the sweet commerce, and you know the commerce would actually make our manners sort of nicer and our interests would be actually interest in making money rather than in making war. And then you then have a question, like, why did it then happen at the peak of capitalist development and liberalism that you go for not a war, which was like an ordinary war? That's not the war like France against Germany in 1870. It was the war that actually included the entire world, that was by far most destructive war up to that point. So I think that's a problem that liberalism has. And of course, Marxism has a problem in 1989, where actually, from the Marxist perspective, it is unthinkable that a society that is more developed, like, you know, socialist, would go back to something which was really transcended. So it's almost, as I said in my book, it's almost like if you were to say that, you know, we had a system today, and we decide actually to go to feudalism, where we invent new lords and counts, and then we actually decide that some people should have forced labor. I mean, it's unthinkable that we would do that. And right. Ideologically, it was unthinkable for Marxists too.
But you're, you know, given your theory, you know, you sort of flip things and say, you know, at part of the book that, in some cases, and I guess particularly in lesser developed countries, that the communist revolutions were in some way a prerequisite for them becoming capitalist today. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, this is actually a very controversial thesis, and I think it is one of the major, I think, parts of the book. In terms of its possible implications, it takes maybe about only 15 pages in an annex, but the idea is as follows. And I take China as a sort of paradigmic example, so let me just use China as an example. So you were like after the October Revolution. In 1920, an event of absolutely first-order global significance happened, and that was a decision by the Comintern and Lenin, actually in particular, and Roy, in Indian Marxist, to include anti-imperialist struggle in the struggle of the working class. You know, that was not obvious, because many fighting for struggle and anti-imperialist struggle was led by national bourgeoisies. So the workers, as we know in India, were actually an infinite and minute fraction of the population. But then the decision was made like that. And in the case of China, for example, you had in front of the Communist Party, which was formed in 1921, exactly 100 years ago, two goals. Very clearly enunciated by Mao, by others, but still today. One is to make the country free of foreign influence. Secondly, destroy all growth impeding feudal institutions. This is education, treatment of women, landlords, rules of the landlords, make a land reform and so on. So they actually did that. But that set the stage for the development of what we now see is de facto capitalism in China and Vietnam, and obviously in India, which was slightly different trajectory, but relatively similar. I will explain that as well. So in other words, my argument is communist parties functionally in the less developed colonized countries had a role that was played by bourgeoisies in the rich independent countries. Bourgeoisie actually got rid of the feudal institutions. In countries that were colonized, bourgeoisie was not strong enough to do it by themselves. They needed actually, and that's what happened, strong centralized parties like communist parties. And they got rid both of the colonialism and of the feudal institutions. Now, they didn't do that because they wanted you know, consciously to bring capitalism. But they actually did that. And, you know, it is not fundamentally, my last point, that is so strange, because in the Marxist framework, strictly speaking, you actually cannot have, you know, communist or socialism, whatever you want to call it, when you, your society is very underdeveloped, where you don't have a working class, where you actually you are at a very sort of a backward stage of development. So it is not totally inconceivable at some level that actually that was even to some extent a role which they, I'm not saying consciously played, but that they... I think, for example, in Deng Xiaoping, it's very clear that he saw development as part of socialism. Whatever develops us, whether it is you know, capitalism or not, it is good for us because that's development.
Right. Well, let's sort of take a step back and slow things down a little bit for our listeners, because we've already covered quite a bit. Yes. So let's talk about the different types of capitalism that you discuss in the book. It's capitalism is now unrivaled, but you know there are a few variants, and then there are subsets of those variants. So maybe you could sort of, you know, outline it for our listeners what's presently at play.
Yes, I would actually, you know, I'm not a huge fan of taxonomy, because I think we have to go beyond that. But I did have to introduce some taxonomy in order simply to explain things. I would start with something which is sort of relatively easy, and that's classical capitalism. So let's suppose you go again to 19th century classical capitalism. You have really division between workers and capitalists, or anyway, people who have most of their income or the entire income from ownership. That could be land, or it could be physical capital, financial capital. And these two groups they don't mingle. In other words, there is no overlap. If you put them, and as you know, actually, I work on income inequality. If you put them in income distribution, these people who receive most of their income from property would be at the top, and the others would be in the middle and the bottom. And each of them would have 100% of their income from one or the other. I contrast that with today's capitalism, say, in the United States, which I call liberal meritocratic. I can later explain why, but for the moment, let's forget these terms and say, how does it differ from the past? And it differs in many respects. But one thing that I think is very important is that we don't have the split between these two factorial incomes, meaning capital and labor, to such an extent as we had in the past. Moreover, we see now at people at the top having both very high income from labor. You know, these are people who are actually workers, technically. I mean, they could be so-called liberal professions like, you know, doctors, engineers, lawyers, and others. They could be lobbyists. They could be software developers. They would be IT people, but their income, or CEOs, their income is still labor. And they also have significant income from capital. So it has really a very different a structure from the classical capitalism. So that would be one difference. And finally, let me put one more, because that's an important one, what I call political capitalism of China, where the production is conducted according to capitalist principles, most of it. However, the state retains large influence on decision-making in the sense it can punish some entrepreneurs, some capitalists, or actually give special favor to the others, and controls certain top areas, as we know, for example, banking, obviously some production of electricity, coal, and things like that, and even, you know, some new areas where the state actually decides to invest. We have seen this for electric cars, for example, in China. So I would just say for the moment, let's keep in mind classical capitalism, which practically is more or less gone from the most developed countries, but it's still present in Latin America. Then this, you know, liberal capitalism and the political capitalism.
Right. So, you know, when we think about this, you say in the book that the U.S. over the last 3 to 4 decades has moved from social democratic capitalism to meritocratic capitalism. What exactly does that mean, and why is that happened?
You know, there I was really using a sort of a approach that John Rawls in his theory of justice was the first to, I mean, proposed. And he what he was interested in is in the following: whether the system, capitalist system, whether that system gives makes some adjustment for the difference in the original conditions with which we are born, for example, our parental wealth, things which are not really, which are exogenous to us, which are not really something that is the result of our effort or work or luck. And there he said, actually, he said, if we take simply what he calls meritocratic capitalism, this is a capitalism where, actually, he called it meritocratic equality, where it's a system where there is no, the only adjustment is equality before the law. So we are all equal before the law. You are not, you don't have greater rights than I. But, you know, if you were born with, you know, lots of money or wealth because of your parents or good connections or whatever, that's something yours. But the more developed type, what he calls liberal equality, would adjust for two things. And actually, I use that quite a lot in the book, even at the end when I do make some recommendations. And the two adjustments, first, is the adjustment in terms of the wealth that you can take, which basically implies fairly high taxation of inheritance. So in other words, if you tax inheritance quite highly, then the advantage that you might have had from your parental background would be diminished. So we would be more equal, you know, the starting positions would be more equal. Second thing is education. So if education is free, or the top education, the best education, is equally available to everybody, then again, our starting positions are equalized. So that was his idea, which I then use in the book, of meritocratic and liberal capitalism. Now, what I think is that the United States and many European countries have moved from this liberal or slash maybe social democratic capitalism towards more meritocratic, in the sense that these two adjustments, inheritance and public education, have become less salient now than they were 30 years ago. So that was the idea. You know, many of the taxes, as we know, have been reduced. You know, obviously, inheritance tax has been significantly reduced. And the public education still exists, it's very clear. But really, the education that gives you a head start is the education that you have to pay a lot of money for, and that's private education. So I think in that sense, there was a reversal towards a less redistributive capitalism compared to the situation before 1980.
Right. You know, when we think about the different forms of capitalism and contrasting the US and China, I think, you know, one of the things that I've appreciated from China's ascendance over the last 30 years is, you know, they've sort of debunked the notion that there's a inherent link between capitalism and democracy. You know, even here in the West, you know, we've seen capitalism prevail as democracy has been, you know, threatened with people like Trump and others who, you know, favor more, you know, protectionistic, you know, economic policies. And I find it comical that, you know, we in the West have tried to instill, you know, the capitalism and democracy, you know, on the Eastern world and in other areas. And while this has happened, China has sort of created a new paradigm of state-led authoritarian capitalism that is beating the U.S., you know, each year when we compare growth rates. You know, now I'm one who worships at the altar of democracy, but, you know, if we're comparing economic growth and that being the primary goal, which, you know, it should never be, but if it were, it sure does seem like authoritarian capitalism, you know, wins out each time. You know, it provides more autonomy to, you know, those who make economic decisions. You know, I mean, for instance, if the Chinese economy were to collapse, they don't have to hear week-long debates about moral hazard and things like we did in 2008 with the housing crisis. They can just quickly unilaterally plug the holes before there's collateral damage. So can you talk a little bit about the trade-offs between capitalism and democracy, or, you know, more specifically between income and political freedom, and I guess maybe how you see this playing out going forward.
You know, I would like to make there two points. So first of all, I think that it is a myth that capitalism and democracy were linked. If you look simply again empirically, and you go back to 1850 and just list all the countries that were capitalist, and over time, you of course realize that capitalism was, for example, in Latin America, but Latin America most of the time was not democratic. Capitalism was in South Africa, but South Africa was not democratic. Capitalism was in Southern Europe, you know, Spain, Portugal, Greece, Turkey, but they were not democratic. Capitalism was in the interwar Central Europe. I would even leave, you know, Nazi Germany aside, but, you know, number of countries like Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Yugoslavia, Hungary, they were all capitalist, but they were not democratic. And I can go on. Japan, for example, during the rise was actually capitalist, but not democratic. So the number of non-democratic capitalist countries, I mean, country years, is greater than the number of capitalist democratic years. Now, more recently, of course, it is true that, of course, the number of democratic capitalist countries has increased. But the connection between these two, as we have seen from historical data, is never one-to-one connection. So in that sense, the fact that we have an authoritarian or whatever, political capitalism of China, Vietnam, Angola, and others is not, or actually I could include, although I don't deal with that for the specific reasons in the book, because I wanted to talk about the genesis of political capitalism, but I could include, for example, Russia, which is clearly a political capitalist country now. So that's not a kind of a historical surprise. So that was my first point. Now, the second point is really this competition between the two capitalists. Now, first of all, China is still a significantly poorer country than the US. So China has a long way to go. However, the speed at which it really traverses that gap is very high, and it is an enormous country. So I can certainly see, as many people do, that in 20 or 30 years, that difference would actually shrink very significantly. In some areas, which actually came as a surprise to many, which top technologically really peak areas, China is already competing very strongly, and in some of them even leading. So that's actually not the development that we were expecting from a country at that mean, that GDP per capita or mean income level. And then I think the competition, in my opinion, would be really based essentially on the economic performance. And there I have to say that I'm of, this is obviously now opinion, so it's not a fact because I cannot prove that, but in my opinion, and that was a little bit reflected in the book, people go essentially where they can make more money. And if they realize that a certain system is delivering goods better, they would tend to actually adopt that particular way of doing things. So I think if China were to sort of consistently outperform, which I said is really a big question because China is still at a lower, much lower level of income, but if it were to consistently outperform, I think that system would actually have a significant feature, a future. Doesn't mean it would control the entire world, but it could actually easily spread because there could be imitators, and both there would be an incentive for China to actually export that model. So there are two things which might happen. You know, China's export, on which I'm a little bit kind of skeptical, and the imitation, if they indeed continue to be successful.
Yeah, well, it seems like they're not slowing down. I mean, you know, let's be honest here. The U.S. economy is not democratic. I mean, in my opinion, it won't be until we take money out of politics. It's, you know, when we really look at it, at least in my view, we have the worst of both the liberal democratic and the political authoritarian orders. You know, we aren't democratic or liberal because lobbyists engulf Washington, you know, creating a system of winners that keep on winning and losers that really never get a chance to compete. But because we're, you know, tethered to the idea of democracy, We don't get to see the gains in economic growth that come with, political authoritarian capitalist structures. Is that an accurate assessment, or do you see it a little differently?
You know, let me go to try to answer it slightly indirectly with looking at China. You know, as I said, China has two, like every big power, like the United States. The United States was both exporting its own model and had imitators because it was so successful. Now, if you look from Chinese perspective, the export of the model of Chinese model is a little bit difficult because China's success is the result of many decisions which are highly specific to China. For example, the most important maybe one, which is very difficult to replicate, is that you have a very large amount of decentralization by provinces where they actually could do, and counties even, could do different policies they could actually try. And then the centralized control, which would then pick the winners and say, well, look, that policy, like, for example, that's how the responsibility system in agriculture started. Oh, look, that policy in such, they still have the first county that did it, was a big success. And then that would actually spread. Now, that combination of decentralization and heavy concentration of power, which is in the Communist Party, is very difficult to replicate. You cannot really package it very easily. You know, the Washington consensus can be much more easily packaged when you go to a country, you go to, Mali, and you say, okay, this is things you will do. You know, you deregulate, you privatize, you let foreign exchange rate free and things like that. Here with the Chinese, they have this problem, in my opinion, of packaging. And they know it. And I think a Belt and Road Initiative is one way, which actually also started very sort of incoherently, is a packaging of the model. Now, the second thing, you might have countries, and I think we already see some of these signs, for example, Ethiopia, that actually look at the Chinese model and they say, well, these guys have had really very high rate of growth. What can we do to have that? And then I think that also for the governing coalition or the people in power, that's very attractive because they don't really have to deal, like Rwanda is another example, with the elections and other things. They can be modernizers in the sense that they would actually improve the economy, bring infrastructure, bring water, electricity to the population. And they are isolated from the political process of the elections and so on. So there is a certain advantage. I would actually see, if you look at, for example, Russia, Putin's popularity is still very high, despite that actually Russia, like China, is not generating economic growth. Russia is in a stagnation. But I don't think that the questioning of the model is very strong. If Putin were to go back to growth rates of 6, 7, 8%, I mean, his popularity, which is now, I think, at about 60, would certainly go at 80, which shows you that it's really economic growth that is key. And people would take, some limits to their freedom, really, without complaining too much.
Yeah, I mean, I think for sure. I mean, it's really, I think even with all the corruption that is, seen in China, there are many people, probably people here in the U.S. that would prefer to have China's form of capitalism that is, with higher economic growth at the expense of civic participation, because, they want to go where the money is.
You know, the civic participation is also sort of somewhat in our narrative is exaggerated. I mentioned this in the book, several things. For example, you take the U.S. participation in the elections. Of course, the last one with 4 years of incessant fight between the two sides has led to 67% turnout rate. But all the elections were actually generating before this one were generating around 50%. So you realize that the election of a person who in many respects has really prerogatives of a king in terms of foreign policy and significant power domestically really does not bring out more than 50% of people. So where is this civic sort of huge, you know, concern about these things. Secondly, I have to say, because I'm very skeptical, not very, but somewhat skeptical of the NGOs, very often they go with, you know, under the pretense of the civic influence. But, you know, when you look at many of them, they're really being essentially captured by several, by an interest. So they're not fundamentally different in many cases from lobbyists. So, you know, we are talking, it's a civic interest, but, you know, it could be a very small sliver of people who have been able to capture it. And it's the case in the US, but I think it's even much more case in other countries where, you know, the civil society, so-called, is much weaker, and basically people don't care about what is happening. You know, politically, they do care about having certain rights. For example, rights obviously to work freely, to have access to information, all that. But there are certain things that they I don't think matter that much for people when it comes to, you know, what may be considered like some, you know, fundamental democratic rights. They, you know, I don't think that it matters. They would maybe rather watch a basketball game than go and, you know, demonstrate or make a point.
Sure, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the next couple decades are really going to sort of put these more democratic capitalist states and back them into a corner when, you know, those their citizens see countries like China and others that try to, you know, replicate that model. Although you said it's difficult to for them to export that model, I think there are going to be some people that are, you know, saying, "Hey, I'd rather have that than what we have." But let's shift a bit and talk a little bit about how the ascendance of capitalism has affected the capital labor relationship. You note that the share of total income going to capital has been rising, and that, you know, capitalists are becoming more important than labor and workers, and that as a result, capitalists have acquired more economic and political power. Now, to me, this seems somewhat, you know, self-reinforcing, but you did note in the book that, you know, while this relationship can be seen in the classical capitalism of, you know, pre-20th century, and, you know, obviously in our current, you know, meritocratic capitalist era, it doesn't occur in the social democratic structure. Why is that? What is different about the social democratic capitalism that where this relationship, this sort of self-reinforcing relationship between capital and political power play out?
Yeah, I think there was, as you know, I'm not originally that, as many people have, you know, argued. Well, there was a sort of a sea change in terms of modern developed capitalism, which happened around 1980s. Of course, it's associated with Reagan and Thatcher, and I think rightly so. You know, there was a disappointment with the performance of some parts of the welfare state, particularly in England. In the US, that was also true, but there were many other elements, as you remember. I actually remember that period with, you know, high inflation, high rates of interest, then the Iran crisis, which all led to Reagan being elected. And of course, arguing that, of course, the problem is the state, the government is the problem. And that really made a big change. And if you look at, and I've worked on these numbers, if you look not only on income inequality in the United States, if you look and the change in social mobility in the United States, everything actually essentially is changing. You see the decline changing about between 1980, 85, and sometimes up to 1990. So that was really a period where, of course, as you were saying in your question, where also the power of capital versus labor increased. I mean, we, of course, remember Reagan firing all the air controllers, right? Which was a symbolic, very important and symbolic change. Well, then what happened is, the, as I was saying in the very beginning, the end of communism and the integration of, you know, millions of people, actually billion, actually including China and India, into the capitalist market, global capitalist market economy, where labor then became much more, there's simply much more labor. So the, as we know in economics, if you have an excess supply, obviously your relative power declines. And I think it's very clear that the relative power of labor in the rich countries went down, partly because of these changes that I was mentioning, which were ideological changes, but partly, in my opinion, dominant change was an objective, quote unquote, change, which made the labor much more abundant, labor working ready to work for much lower wages, much more abundant, labor that was producing goods in China and elsewhere and exporting them to the United States, or that was actually willing to be employed by the U.S. capital. So the, all of that led to the declining power of labor and the declining labor share. So I don't. To me, it's not a huge mystery. I think that the economists disagree. There are three basically possible drivers: technological change, which substituted some labor; globalization, they did what I just explained with in the influence of China in particular; and policy changes. And I think they are mutually sort of reinforcing. And my general sort of view is that globalization played maybe the dominant role, but whichever of the three is, I think all three of them went together in the same direction. So I think that's what happened then, and I think that continues until today. And my last point on that, now, is this going to change now? It's not impossible. So I think that we might have, in some respects, come to the end of that very long period from 1980 maybe to 2021.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's interesting in the book is you say that just because capital share of income goes up, this in itself right. does not drive unequal outcomes and inequality. It's the fact that people have capital in unequal proportions. If we all had the same proportion of capital
right.
and capital share of, you know, national income goes up, inequality wouldn't change. Now, clearly this isn't the world we live in.
Absolutely. You know, let me now explain that, because sometimes it's not very clear, because we're so much used to having rich people essentially having quite a lot of capital income. And this is, of course, true. You know, in the U.S., if you look at the financial wealth of the United States, that's essentially owned by 10% of people, because about 90% of all financial assets are concentrated in the hands of 10%. But theoretically, as I just said, theoretically, let's suppose that our incomes remain the same as they are now, but the composition of our income is such that if somebody has $100, 30 comes from capital and 70 from labor, and somebody has 10 million, but then again, you know, 30 million come from capital and 70 million come from labor. In that condition, the rising share of capital would actually keep the ratios, and that's what economists mean by inequality, because it's relative inequality, the ratios between the top guys and the others, or the bottom guys, unchanged. So if you sort of think of that, then you, of course, can say, okay, so how are we going, if we're going to face an increasing capital share in the future because of automation, robotics, and so on, what should we do so that it does not spill out immediately into rising interpersonal inequality? And of course, a straight answer is, of course, we can tax that capital, but differently, what we can do is try to spread it out. You know, I know that's not going to take 5 years or, you know, 10 years. It's a much longer process. But an attempt to give fiscal advantages to the middle class to have more access to capital, an attempt to actually have workers receive and have shares, which would be shares that they would just, you know, have like now CEOs do, and sell them or not sell them. I think the attempts to do that would actually lead towards some, I would not say the equalization, but some deconcentration of that capital share. So we would have less of an automatic transmission from an increasing share of capital into higher interpersonal inequality. I know these are really too many words here, but what I mean is that actually the rising power of capital and rising capital income would not immediately make the rich richer. So that would be a little bit of a dampening effect, because also the middle class would have financial assets.
Right. I mean, I think the key here is trying to get to a point where everybody has capital, because right now capital is being held, and you know, a very, very small proportion of individuals have capital, and those people, as you noted earlier, are also laborers now. The idea of the leisure capital class is really no more. And you know, if we want to actually tackle this, we have to find a way to get people capital. So you do think that it is possible to sort of create a new paradigm where, you know, workers are given you know, a stake in the company that they work for.
You know, people oftentimes say, and I'm aware of that problem, that actually many workers might not even want to be capitalists, so they would sell this. And this is true. But, you know, some would keep. And when people say, well, this is not going to work, I look around and I say, well, how does it work for the CEOs and all these people who do receive shares? So it works for them. So why wouldn't it work for people down the line? You know, maybe not everybody. I know that, of course, we are not going to have the bottom 30% of the population really become capital owners, because they first really need to get, I mean, many of them need to get out of debt. They need housing, all that. They're not going to start investing in the stock market. But that still leaves about 2/3 of the population that potentially could. So I don't think it is as a proposal. I don't think it's dead on arrival. I think we have not done sufficient attempt to actually make that. You know, Margaret Thatcher, I mean, ironically, she was actually in favor of people's capitalism. And she started doing certain things, but it didn't go very far. Secondly, of course, some of that is done through the pension funds in quite a few countries, where actually Nordic countries are an example of that, where you have a significant percentage of the population in with forced savings, which go into the pension funds, and then they're a little bit what I call pensioner capitalism, because many of the people don't have capital income until they retire, and then they have actually capital income. So I think there are many ways that one can think of trying to spread really ownership of capital much more deeply than it is now.
For sure. I mean, if the returns to capital are continuing to be greater than the returns to labor, we got to find a way to get laborers capital. I mean, it seems that simple to me. I mean, I'm very, very concerned about the long-term impacts of inequality. I mean, there's so many studies that show how elevated inequality leads to slower growth and worsening outcomes across the board. You know, my question for you is, if no redistributional policy measures or even limited redistributional measures are taken by the state, will capitalism in its natural state sow the seeds of its own destruction, as Marx suggested? Or is it, you know, that, you know, taken, you know, to its extreme, that capitalist states going at their current on their current trajectories will just arrive at a steady state of zero growth?
That's really a difficult question. You know, I'm actually writing my new book, which looks at how inequality was perceived by Adam Smith, Ricardo, Marx. And really, Marx is very interesting because there are two different interpretations, one of them being that essentially the capitalist society would be characterized increasingly by high concentration of wealth in the hands of the few, and really sort of immiseration of the others. But The quotes for that are relatively few. Actually, one can even argue that Marx thought that there would be an increase in the real wage, because there are quite a few statements to that effect. So it's very difficult, really, I think, to say how capitalism would evolve if no other corrective mechanisms have been introduced. Because one of the sort of strengths of capitalism is and of the sort of liberal democratic capitalism is ability to self-correct. You know, that was, of course, after the Great Depression. That was with the FDR in the United States. And I think it could be even now or in the future. And I think that in the US, it seems to me, on two important areas, people are becoming much more aware of the negative sides of inequality. And the two important areas, which I'm going to say in a minute, are very deeply ingrained in the American psyche and history. And the first one is that higher inequality reduces equality of chances. In other words, that the higher inequality means lower social mobility. You know, as you know, in the past, the view was, well, okay, doesn't matter, we are unequal now, but opportunities or social mobility is high. Well, now we know more and more that that's not the case. We know empirically that's not the case. So that's one of the very important foundational issues in the US. So people would start really thinking twice about high inequality if it really entrenches that advantage. Second point is the role of inequality, lobby power, and political influence on sort of undermining certain democratic tenets of the democratic system. And so that also something that we know simply because we of course have the data on first that really topics that are really issues that matter to the rich are the topics that are really discussed or acted upon in Congress or elsewhere. And secondly, we have the data about an incredible concentration of political campaign contributions. So I think on these two levels, people are really questioning inequality. And I think in that sense, it seems to me there is much greater support now politically to do something about it. And in that sense, the self-corrective mechanism is working. It works slowly, but I think it's not non-existent.
Yeah. You know, you said in the book that the remarkable period of reduced income and wealth inequalities in rich countries that lasted roughly from the end of World War II to the early 1980s relied on four pillars: strong trade unions, mass education, high taxes, and large government transfers. My question is, you know, since unions are basically dead here in the US, can taxation alone fix the problems of intergenerational inequality, or do we have to find a way to bring back union participation and dramatically increase social transfers? Because it seems that, you know, politicians have quite a bit of faith in the effects of just, you know, using taxes alone to reduce inequality.
Well, Edward, this is a great question. Actually, let me go through these four pillars, because in my book, I say I'm really skeptical about reusing them in the new sort of world. Trade unions, as you said, I think are basically not only in the US, in all OECD countries, they've been on the decline. And I think the reason is that simply the workplace, as we all know, is now differently organized. You know, there is no Fordism anymore. There are no, large halls with thousands of people. It's much more difficult to organize people if they're not together, if their interests are not very clearly aligned. So the decline of trade union power is, I think, of course, there was a political element there too, but I think there is a certain element which was due to simply economics. Then when you come to education was such an important element, and it continues to be. But the education is not merely having many years of schooling as it was in the past. Now, really, rich countries like the U.S. are actually at the same level at a ceiling. You cannot go to average years or 25 years of education. It just doesn't exist. So what it means for education now is not to allow the elite, which is using the private education system, which is extremely expensive, to use that to essentially convey the advantages to their children. So that's a different type of education. Not simply everybody goes to school, because that's already done largely. Then the third one is taxation. I believe it has to play a role, but we cannot put all the eggs on taxation, because then you will have to tax everybody at the rates which are politically unrealistic. And transfers will, of course, have to increase if you increase taxation. But again, I do notice, and I think we all notice, that the public in the rich countries, including the US, are much less optimistic about, or is much more skeptical about, the use of transfers than they were 40 years ago. So in other words, they're much more skeptical about government now than they used to be. And that's why I come with this whole story of deconcentration of capital ownership, because it plays on a different table, if you will, like you play chess. Well, this is at a different table, of chess. And I think that's why it is another way of, it's a way of substituting for the weakness of this, of some of the four pillars.
Right. I was going to ask you a question about inheritance taxes, and I think I'll do that in a moment. But the things that you said about the education system, really are really interesting. I think it was it Finland that a while back outlawed all private schools, and now it's just, if you want to go to school, you have to go to a public school, and as a result, they've seen their educational outcomes rise. And so I wanted to hear your thoughts on the idea of making K through 12 private school illegal in this country. I mean, I support the idea. I think it would put everybody on a much equal footing. I think more money would be directed towards public schools, and I think it would do a lot more good than harm. What say you on that?
I have first to say a caveat. Actually, I came to this issue from the point of view of inequality. So I'm not really an education specialist. And this is a topic which has been studied, in extenso in the United States. So there are, I think, hundreds of people who know much more, thousands maybe, much more about that than I. I come, as I said, from an inequality point of view. And my opinion, let me start with, expensive private education. In my opinion on that, there is also a nice book that influenced me by Daniel Markovich about the meritocracy trap, which essentially, I think, sees that high cost of education, and not only university education, because it goes all the way, as we know, it goes all the way down to pre-K, sees it as a sort of a way to monopolize the educational system, so that your children, if you're rich, that your children do not have to compete with 80% of other children who actually cannot access that educational system.
Right.
So you really have created a monopoly. And that's why I say in my book, the high cost of education should be seen something in the interest of the rich. Now, if I have $1 million, it really doesn't matter for me if education for that year is 50,000 or 80,000. Maybe I should even like to have it 100,000, because there will be even fewer kids who will compete with my child. And so that's how I see it. And if you see it like that, then you say, well, there should be some ways of changing the balance between public and private, which means making public more attractive in generating higher wages later on, which means making public better, which means giving more money to the public. So I think the logic goes like that. If I want really the best kids to go to the public, why they would go? Because they would get higher wages after that. So why would they go? they would go there because they would have the best teachers. How do I get the best teachers? Because I give them more money. So I clearly need to have more money in the public. So that was my logic. And then following that logic, I thought actually one can argue about taxation of the endowments of the private colleges, which, as we know, have become, of course, extremely rich. And on the other hand, have not really even expanded very much in terms of their intake. So they're really very elitist. So that's one possibility. You could even shame them. That was my other idea, is if you have one or two of the top ones contributing certain percentage of their annual revenues to something which would be the public fund for improvement, then the others, for under political pressure, would actually do the same. So I think in any case, the point, in my opinion, would be to reverse that relationship. So that, as it happened actually in the United States in the 1940s and the 50s, the backbone of the US success was really an extremely strong system of state education. And I think that backbone is being slightly, sometimes even more than slightly, eroded. So, right. So that was the idea.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your proposal for inheritance taxes. You said in the book that you would like to see inheritance taxes sort of fund a grant for every citizen, and I very much like that idea. Unfortunately, I don't really see inheritance taxes, at least here in the U.S., as a great engine for revenue, because the potency of inheritance taxes has been greatly reduced by Congress continually raising the exemption thresholds.
Right.
Having said that, I do see inheritance taxes as a great way to destroy wealth at the top, which I think is vital for the survival of democratic capitalism. Unfortunately, though, the idea of wealth destruction or wealth redistribution is anathema to most voters, even those who would be on the receiving end. So how do you view the future of inheritance taxes here in the U.S.?
You know, just to say a few words about what you said about the very top of the income distribution, one of the, I think, unfortunate developments which came with this change in the ideological climate is that we have, I think, become very used to the fact that people, billionaires and others, are influencing not only the political process, they're influencing sort of what we know through, for example, Bezos' purchase of the Washington Post and similar things, the Atlantic magazine also, and other really major outlets, Bloomberg and so on. And then on top of that, they're actually having much greater inroads even in the educational system. So the educational system is then being, in some sense, the public is being gutted from two sides, one that I mentioned, which is quite well known, and the other one that even public universities like my own, City University of New York, they really more and more depend on private contributions. And, I'm not against them, but the point is that private contributions should not determine the way that you study. The way that what you study is something that is a result of a public consensus, which go through entirely different channels. And then if you then show up and say, okay, I'll give you $5 million to study X, well, nowadays, of course, you have that power because you have the money. And I worked, as you mentioned, at the World Bank, where actually also the same process is being carried on, is that you have private money even influencing what international organizations do. So we have become really used to that. And the question is, are we going to do something about that influence? Now, we can, of course, reduce that influence of differing regulations or measures, but one way to reduce it is essentially not to have people with so many billions on the top. And I think it comes down to that, you would have really two choices. One choice is, as Piketty argued, annual wealth tax. Another choice is the inheritance tax. I know that inheritance tax is often not popular, even with people who actually would never pay a dime. Right. That inheritance tax. So I know, and actually I don't have a particular sort of preference. I think it's simpler because you have it at the very end and it very clearly conveys that actually it is not, as they say, it is not punishment of the children, because essentially these children have not contributed as individuals anything to that money, and they would still get 80% of that money anyway. You know, we are not talking about taxes of 100%. Or the alternative is to have a wealth tax, much more important wealth tax annually. But I think something has to be done with such extravagant wealth, which really, as it was saying in the first part of the answer, which really now broadens in influence in all the different areas, from education, politics, international organization, health systems. We have seen that with Gates, and everywhere. And that, I think, is not the development that is desirable.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I have a couple final questions before I let you go. I know you're very busy. You talked about in the book, and you mentioned earlier here today that, you know, had communism won out over capitalism in the 20th century, globalization probably wouldn't exist. I don't know if it wouldn't exist, but it would not be as prevalent, and the notion of money making would not be the universal language that it is today. It sure does seem like people are increasingly dedicating their lives to making money above all else. So do you think capitalism's ascendance has made societies less altruistic? Has it altered our value system? You know, has it made us less human?
Yes, let me, well, that's such a difficult question. Let me just first explain my argument about communism and globalization, because to some, it may seem really the opposite. You know, communism ideologically was internationalist. So why wouldn't they actually have globalization and internationalism? The reason, the key reason, I believe, is that communism went together in the economic sphere with large redistribution at the level of the state and subsidization. The problem with that was that then each communist state did not want the subsidies to spill over, their subsidies to spill over to somebody else. And I'll give you a very simple example, which I think would explain that. If you are, and that was the case, for example, in Poland versus Germany, or the other way around, if you're in Poland and you subsidize meat consumption because you're essentially buying meat from the producers or state-owned companies at 10, but selling it in because you subsidize it at 5, you don't want foreigners to come and buy that meat, because then basically you're giving 5 units of zloty or whatever to a foreigner. So, right. You know, the very subsidization system was leading to the autarkic economies. And so this is kind of an ironic situation, because ideologically the system was internationalist, but in reality it became, for those reasons and others, very nationalistic. So I don't think there would be globalization, because globalization is also driven, as we know, by capital that wants to make more money, and it doesn't care where it is making that more money. It can go anywhere. So in the case where you had state-owned capital, it didn't have the incentive that the private-owned capital does have. But for capitalism to be so, dynamic and energetic, it needs to have a value system in us that supports that. And this is where my argument with many people about climate change and the growther comes in, is they believe that somehow we can change our human nature now, which has been really built by capitalism very strongly, that we might stop caring about higher income. But that, I think, is very, very unrealistic, and it shows in everyday activities that, of course, we care. We all want to have more income. We want to be wealthier. We want to travel. We want to have a better TV. We want to have a better car. So that's something which, of course, without which capitalism could not function. You know, if I decide, like, I'm never going to replace my iPhone ever again, you know, well, there would be no new demand for the iPhones. They would not produce any one. And likewise for any other things, cars or whatever. So, you know, capitalism depends on our acquisition, spirit of acquisition and desire for acquisition. And that's why I see these two parts of profit motive in the enterprise side, company side, and on the other hand, our own desire to improve our life and to follow money to be really mutually reinforcing. And to some extent, of course, I can see, well, that actually then altruism becomes really much less important. That doesn't mean that people are not nice. And of course, there are many arguments made that capitalism also reinforces some kind of superficial niceness, because in order for you to buy something from me, you know, I have to be nice. You know, I should not, you know, I remember when I first went to China in the 1980s, I read an article which said that that the shop assistants are prohibited from beating customers. You know, I'm not joking. There was an article said like they are not allowed to beat customers. Well, you know, if you were in capitalism to beat your customers, you will not have too many of them. So you become nice. But it doesn't mean that there was this niceness in everyday sort of relationship, which is somewhat superficial niceness, versus maybe some other more altruistic features, which obviously, in my opinion, have to take second place. Let me just say on that, I think there is a very clear, that was historically very clear difference in Adam Smith between the theory of moral sentiments, which really deals with our relationship with other individuals with which when we are close, friends, family, and so on, where our behavior is a one type of behavior, and our behavior with the commercial sphere, where our behavior is different. Actually, it is really propelled by you know, desire for gain. And I think that's how I see the situation or the split now.
For sure. So the big question, Professor, which is, I guess, one of the many reasons why we're talking about this today, which type of capitalism is best? I mean, I guess we would first need to define best, or what we mean by best, but what do you think, I guess, is the most robust or fair form of capitalism that you have studied, that you see today, or, you know, maybe that you envision for the future?
I think that, you know, a capitalism which would reduce extreme wealth and reduce the influence of extreme wealth on the political and educational and media parts, and which would make opportunities of people, I'm not saying equal because they would never be equal, but less unequal, would be, these would be two big steps that would make capitalism much more attractive. And these are not, I'm not talking here about steps asking people to, you know, become altruistic or to actually care about people whom they don't know as much as they care about their family. You know, these would be, I think these are very unrealistic objectives. But the objective of reducing the really extremely high incomes and wealth to more manageable proportions, and not allowing their influence on what I was saying before, like, you know, politics, education, and so forth, is not something totally, I don't think it's unrealistic. So that system would make, of course, chances of people who are born to modest families much greater, and that would not allow the formation of what I think is a danger now of formation of an elite, you know, and that's elite. It's a very interesting elite because, as we were saying before, it combines capital and labor. It intermarries, because we know that what is called assortative mating, they marry more and more people who are similar to them. And that elite is very hardworking, which, of course, it's not a leisure class, so it doesn't have this ethical opprobrium against them. And then it's transferring all this, reproducing all these advantages for their children. And I think that kind of a capitalism would essentially then be a capitalism of an elite, which would be, I think, a dangerous sort of situation.
Well, Professor, thank you thank you so much for joining us today. I know our listeners and I have learned very much from you, and we thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us.
Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure, like the last time, and you know, would be happy to be there again.
Well, if you want to get more Branko Milanović, his book Capitalism Alone is available on the Demand Side's library page. And if you want to access all of Professor Milanović's research, visit the Stone Center on Socioeconomic Inequality. Professor Milanović, thank you again.
Thank you very much.
Well, that's it for us here at the Demand Side. I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Which Type of Capitalism is Best? With our very special guest, Branko Milanović. Make sure to check out all the episodes of The Demand Side on The Demand Side's landing page, wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to visit thedemandside.com for access to opinion pieces, books, news, and videos. Thank you all for joining us today. And remember, if you're forced to choose sides, always choose The Demand Side. Until next time.